to the Little Red Podcast, which brings you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. I'm Graham Smith from the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University. This week, something completely different. This year marks a decade since the 2008 Sichuan earthquake, which left 88,000 people dead. Back in March, Louisa hosted a panel on this very topic at the annual meeting of the Association for Asian Studies in Washington, D.C.
Back in 2008, I was part of an NPR team who covered that quake, and I kept returning to the area for the next 5 years. On that day in 2008, some of our team happened to already be in Chengdu when the ground first started to shake. Melissa Block was carrying out an interview, and she captured the exact moment on tape.
What's going on? The whole building is shaking. The whole building is shaking. Oh my goodness. We're in the middle of an earthquake?
Earthquake,
the whole block is shaking.
Yeah.
Pieces, the top of the church is falling down. The ground is shaking underneath our feet, and all of the people are running out in the street. As we're standing here, birds are flying. The ground is undulating under my feet.
Thousands of children died when 7,000 classrooms collapsed. When I visited those crumbled heaps which once were schools, I could see how corners had been cut to save money, with foundational columns simply crumbling. 5 million people were made homeless. It was a clarifying moment during which we saw a different China. A short moment of true media openness, massive mobilization from community groups and volunteers, with a new sense of solidarity, and amidst the tragedy, some glimmers of hope. So what happened? I was joined by Christian Saras from Colorado College, Xu Bin, a sociologist from Emory University, Kang Yi from Hong Kong Baptist University, and Maria Repnikova, a media scholar from Georgia State University. At the time, the earthquake seemed like such a potential watershed moment in so many areas. But were they real changes that it brought, or were they more of a mirage? I started by asking this question to Christian Saras.
So immediately after the earthquake, most of the publications that came out about it were referring to the amount of volunteering and activism after the earthquake as a watershed moment. And if you look at some of the titles of the articles that were written at that time, it was referring to 2008 as this point at which the emergence of civil society or of the seeds of a new future where society and social organizations play a larger role in governance. And one of the things that struck me is that most of those arguments were based on research done within the first 3 months after the earthquake. So in the rescue period, the Chinese Communist Party and the state was much more friendly or at least tolerant of broader participation. As soon as the reconstruction period started, however, I argue that the Communist Party began to reassert control and more of a top-down control over every aspect of the process. And one of the reasons for that, I argue in my book, is if we look at the underlying logic of power and the Communist Party's legitimation, it depends on the Communist Party providing benevolence, care, economic support, strength. All of these things are actually indivisible. So even in conditions where NGOs might actually help the party achieve specific governance goals, they still pose a problem and a threat to the party because it needs to maintain a monopoly over political power. So for me, the earthquake became this opportunity in which the Communist Party is demonstrating and revitalizing all of the underlying foundations of its own legitimacy. So think about this. You have, in the initial aftermath of the quake, you have protesting parents who are asking questions about why these tofu dreg schoolhouses collapsed. So cutting off that discourse. Instead, the Communist Party was insistent in repeating the message that the earthquake was a tianzai. It was a natural disaster. It was not a renhuo. It was not a man-made catastrophe. And so if you look at all of the propaganda, if you look at the banners, if you look at the ways in which the earthquake was talked about, there were slogans such as, earthquakes are without feeling, only the party has emotions, be grateful to the Communist Party for the new roads, the new bridges, for the new houses. So in many ways, the Communist Party was arguing that in only 3 years of Reconstruction time, we were able to move over 5 million people, which is greater than the entire municipal population of Los Angeles. And all of this is precisely because of China's political system and the ability for top-down mobilization and commitment and party leadership. And in fact, if you look at the way they referred to the earthquake, they referred to the post-earthquake reconstruction as a qiji, as a miracle. And they also refer to the reconstruction in terms such as to produce a great leap of development, or kua yue shi fajan. So they were actually arguing that we can achieve 20 to 30 years of development in this short window of reconstruction by mobilizing the entire state apparatus. So here you see those kinds of flickers of hope that there would be a reconfiguration of the relationship between state and society, I think, die out rather quickly. And instead, you have the Communist Party reasserting not only its control over the process, but its display of the underlying aspects of its legitimacy.
Thank you. Kang Yi, I'll ask you to go next, because in your book you have a whole chapter called New Tasks, Old Approaches, where you talk about how, despite facing these new tasks, a lot of the old problems emerge, like this sort of disregard for rules and this love of symbolic face projects. So why do you think the Communist Party was not able to find new approaches?
At that time, I was arguing that the government indeed was facing with this challenge of it's what I call as a adaptation quandary, which that local government seems happy to embrace a lot of new changes that will certainly facilitate their operation and also improve their performance. But at the same time, they were really clung to their old ways of doing things and old ways of thinking, which really focus on domination and also exclusion. And they all the time, they suspected that the non-state actors might threaten their power and also might make trouble for the local governors. So it turned out what I have observed in the field was that the local government, the way they tried to embrace changes was designing the new mechanisms of assimilation and also exclusion. And after that, actually, in the past 9 years throughout my fieldwork, I indeed followed the development of a variety of indigenous NGOs and their interaction with the local governments. And I learned from fieldwork over these years that quite a few overseas NGOs that founded local NGO activities after the earthquake were annoyed by the government's bureaucratic style and increasing administrative interventions, and also felt very frustrated when they realized that their invested resources were being depleted with only a negligible effect on local governance. So one after another, they have reduced or withdrawn their financial support. I remember in 2016 and 2017, many analysts were discussing the potential chilling effects of this foreign NGO management law. But what I had observed in Sichuan showed that even without explicit legal intervention, local government could easily discourage overseas support and funding to local NGOs by simply taking a predatory approach, just consuming the overseas resources, but at the same time marginalizing their impacts in local governance.
Now, Xu Yun, I was going to ask you about, in the field of civic engagement, we saw that initial rush of volunteers and civic engagement. What happened to that?
Thank you. Basically, there was a tremendous amount of optimism right after the earthquake. And we hear the claim that 2008 was the birth year of the civil society. But now it's been 10 years. If we look back, and this kind of optimism has gone. Well, of course, the claim itself is historically wrong because, you know, Chinese civil society started long before the Sichuan earthquake. Overall, we believe that the 1990s was the time period that social organizations at least actually started its rapid development. So that claim actually was historically wrong. But the point now, if we look back at the civil society development since the Sichuan earthquake, we are much less optimistic than we were in 2008 and even 2009. There are several things to consider. One is that we do see the development of some sectors and some activities and some type of civic engagement, for example, volunteering. Those grassroots volunteering and the volunteering in general has become a fad, particularly among younger generation. And also different kinds of volunteering, crowdsourcing kind of thing. It's a very new type of civic engagement has already become a fad among the younger generation. But at the same time, we find there's a huge gap between those warm, harmless volunteering and more serious civic engagement, which is represented in the public deliberation of the social problems, very pressing social problems. That kind of a volunteering or civic engagement has its political limit, which was set up by the state. And from Kang Yi's observation in these years, which is very true, even those formal organizations in the disaster zone later have this or that kind of limitations. But also I want to emphasize that when we look at a civil society, we need to also look at the individual volunteers and very, very grassroots, even more grassroots than the grassroots organizations. There are small groups, individual volunteers who went to Wenchuan and still are doing some of the civic engagement in other places, and they are having this political trouble and limitation as well. And it's more like a personal choice under some political context to see that whether you want to so-called cross the red line between the political and the apolitical civic engagement. And it's not just the personal choice. It's more like a reinforcing process between the political context and personal choice over the years. So now, overall, if we look back at the Sichuan earthquake now, we see the civil society development in a much less optimistic way.
I remember right after the earthquake happened, a lot of us were out on the ground, and I went up to the Zipingpu Dam. There were all these rumors that the dam had cracks in it and was about to explode or burst or something. And there were a lot of Chinese journalists up there as well who had gone off by themselves, had not obeyed orders. I was in China for 10 years. It was one of the only times where I felt that the Chinese journalists and I, we were reporting the same story. We were working together. We were pressing officials together. For a moment, it was really exciting to be working together in that way. So what happened?
So to start with the official openness, a number of interviewees in my project talked about the Wenchuan earthquake as a kind of breaking point, similar to the SARS disaster. The idea that it was something that was a watershed moment for crisis communication. And some even suggested that it was a point in time when crisis communication became institutionalized. So it was a norm for officials to set up PR conferences, to give out more information, to be more open with the public, both at the central level, but also at the local level. Following this case in my book, the beginning of this reportage started out with a kind of a ban on all media coverage and a very conservative policy on behalf of the party state. But then once the journalists were already en route to the disaster zone, and they were already in flight to Wenchuan, the government ended up changing its policy and facilitating more openness and setting up a lot of PR conferences and all kinds of different activities to share information. And a lot of my interviewees talked about the fact that they've never had such an open, kind of positive, constructive experience with local officials, but also central-level officials on the ground. So this was something of a watershed kind of experience for many interviewees in the media, but also crisis communication experts. I found that in some ways that the PR kind of approach to crises has remained in place in other crises I've observed up until this day. There's just more and more kind of systematic sharing of information with journalists, both foreign and domestic. But this kind of sharing doesn't always end up translating into real transparency or honesty, right? And many interviewees talked about the fact that it's sort of like a controlled transparency by the state because they only give out information that they want to share. So this kind of transparency, in many ways, is kind of what I call manufactured transparency. It's something that gets really heavily constrained and deliberately controlled by the party. But to some extent, according to crisis management experts, it's still a step in the right direction of kind of westernization of communication practices by the government. So that's the first watershed. And the second one, going back to Luisa's question about journalists, something I focused on a lot, the investigative reporting that took place following the disaster kind of unfolding. So the first moment of coverage was really quite positive about unity. But then about a week after, when the crisis of the school collapse has emerged and everybody was observing that crisis, and Chinese journalists rushed into the field, in particular journalists from the famous Southern Weekly, Nanfang Zhoumo, and later on Cai Jing magazine, which some of you may be familiar with, out of Beijing, has published a really long report in early June. After a lot of the censorship directives have been already placed, they broke the directives and published a really in-depth study, also questioning kind of the central state indirectly. The response to those reports was quite mixed by the state. On the one hand, an acknowledgement that there was a problem and things have to be addressed. And the acknowledgement really showed itself through fast reconstruction of the schools and a huge propaganda campaign disseminated through the media, showcasing the responsiveness of the government in reaction to the scandal. But the second element of that, which goes back to, I think, to Christian's point as well, of kind of the first state versus the second phase or even the longer phase after the disaster, is actually the ignorance and kind of a real deliberate, I think, ignoring of the accountability issue that emerged in the earthquake that I think foreign journalists as well as Chinese journalists were really pushing for. Who is responsible? Who is going to go to jail? How do we change the situation from reoccurring? And in this case, nobody was really held accountable. And every year, the topic has become more and more sensitive. So every time I would go back and ask the same specialists as well as journalists if they were able to investigate, go back to the site, the answer was absolutely not. And I just wanted to conclude with a quote from one of my interviewees who was a key editor covering this disaster for the time period of the earthquake, but also following up on it later on. So her response to my question of whether she was able to report, she says, "In reality, I believe that if there were no censorship bans stopping the coverage of the school scandal and other sensitive issues, critical reports could be done in more depth and detail. You cannot find the real causes of problems so quickly after a major disaster. In the United States following the 9/11, media incessantly reported and investigated, and only after a long time they were able to come out with clear answers. Same thing with the recent earthquake in Japan. Only a year later, the media was able to reveal partial truths to the public. But we have been reined in. We have no way of doing more. If I had a way to do it, I certainly would. But for now, I do not see an opening. The situation is very particular to China." So this was her very pessimistic tone about just how far the media can go and when it comes to pushing for a different policy response and challenging the response over the years, it seems like the space just continues to shrink.
So I want to go back to that moment a week after the earthquake happened when there was this really unprecedented act by the Communist Party was to declare a day of mourning for ordinary people. And there were these big rallies in public squares, people chanting "jiayou" and things like that. And it was a day when the party really withdrew from public spaces to allow for this moment of commemoration. And it, I think, allowed for this moment of high emotion, but it was also quite a useful. It served all these other kind of functions for the government. I mean, Xubin, why do you think that happened in 2008? Why was there this day of mourning for ordinary people, something that had never happened before?
I imagine this is a question for me because there's one chapter in my book about this mourning ritual. And this is actually taken for granted by the Western observer because after disasters, you always have mourning rituals, right, for disaster victims. But this is historically unprecedented in China because before this earthquake, national mourning, all the state funerals were for leaders, soldiers, and the people who can embody the state. And that was the first time that the Chinese government held a national mourning for disaster victims who actually did not have any heroic deeds, simply died of misfortune. So it was a historically watershed moment, I would say. But if we look at the long process before this very simple but very powerful ritual, we'll find this was actually advocated by the civil society or some of the intellectuals and liberal media who started this proposal long before the Sichuan earthquake, 10 years before the Sichuan earthquake, in 1998, when there was a Yangtze River huge flood. That was 1998. But 10 years later, in 2008, And people raised that proposal again. But this time, the situation was totally different because it was the Olympic year. And the Chinese state was desperate in repairing its moral image because of some of the issues and events before the earthquake, such as the Tibetan uprising in March, and also the Olympic torch relay in April, and a snowstorm in January and February. So the Chinese state has a PR crisis. Now it's a good time to repair its moral image. And also this mourning is a very simple symbolic gesture made by the state. Just allow the people to go to the squares and to do their own ritual without doing anything. The only thing the state did is to lower the national flags at half-staff. And also air sirens blared. That's it. That's basically it. So it's a very simple move for the state, but it was very powerful. In my memory, that was the first time, or probably the only time, the Chinese state was unanimously praised by all kinds of media, including Hong Kong media, which were otherwise very hostile to the Chinese state. So that was a very interesting symbolic moment. And later it became a convention now in Yushu earthquake and other big disasters. You have at least have some provincial level national mourning for disaster victims. So that was what happened in 2008.
Christian, you've written about how Sichuan transformed itself into a site of party benevolence. How do you think it was useful for the party to react in this way? And how did they kind of tread that line between allowing people into public space but stopping, for example, parents of children who had died in the schools from using that to protest?
The complement to what Bin was also talking about is that unofficial or unauthorized forms of mourning then had to be policed or banned. So if you can look at, like, Ai Weiwei's art, when he put together with the backpacks from the dead school children and spelled out the quotation from a mother who lost her child, "She lived happily in this world for 7 years." Or when Ai Weiwei took rebar and then, you know, straightened it. And so all of those art projects are actually forms of counter mourning. Or Ai Weiwei and Tan Zorin, they were doing similar projects, even though they weren't related to each other. And both of their projects of collecting the individual names and biographical details of the school children that died, which they refer to as Gongmin Diaocha, or citizen investigations, all of that was also actually performing the state's responsibility and promise to release and to publish that information, something that the state and party was unwilling to do. And so that form of mourning the actual singular life or lives that were lost in the earthquake became a fundamental challenge to the way the state was discursively framing its post-quake benevolence and operations. So you remember how I talked in the beginning a little bit about the difference between Tianzai, natural disaster, and Renhuo, man-made catastrophe. If it's a natural disaster, then obviously the Communist Party's response is one of a savior that comes in, that protects the people, that provides the people, that gives them the gift of new life. And so in many ways, all of the discourse after the earthquake, for me, is a variation on the Meiyou Gongchan Dang, Meiyou Xin Zhongguo from the Mao era. No Communist Party, no new China. Without us, there's just the death and terror of nature. Right? So it's precisely the party organization that is responsible for providing people with new homes, roads, and access. But after the earthquake, in the People's Daily, they would publish editorials on the anniversary of the earthquake. And in the editorials, they will specifically go after the U.S.'s political system and say, look at what happened after Hurricane Katrina. You have so many people who are still homeless or living in trailers. It exposed all of the racism of the U.S. And they're right. But what they're doing with that is they're saying, well, look, so here in China, we have a one-party system that cares for its people and makes good on its commitment. So this goes back to what Bin was saying about that kind of revitalization of these core tenets of governance. And it's attempting to demonstrate these. But to do that, it has to simultaneously then control the kinds of public displays of emotions. So one of the things that really struck me to respond to your question is when I was doing field work in the earthquake zone, the party orchestrated a gratitude education campaign, or a gan en jiao yu huo dong, in the schools and in the workplaces in order to teach people how to properly display gratitude for the gift of the reconstruction. And I'll never forget one of the interviews that stood out with me the most was a very kind of candid cadre who said to me, look, if I give you a gift and it's not what you wanted, it's not what you needed, I didn't even consider who you are at all, but I give it to you, is it still a gift? And on top of that, I enforce you to basically profess your gratitude to me.
Maria, I wanted to ask you in particular about the media coverage of that moment. I was actually going through my stuff and I found all the front pages that were from that one day of mourning. And it really struck me that all of the front pages were completely different, as something that you wouldn't see in the current time. You know, there were different pictures for every single newspaper. And you've also written about how there was a lot of kind of emotion in the coverage, all this idea of we are all one trend people. I mean, how much of that was top down, directed from the state, and how much of that was bottom up?
The first week or so was pretty much filled with these emotional messages, and in particular the moment of celebrating unity but also grieving together. And it was both top down and bottom up. I don't think there was kind of one way flow. So on the one hand, these were the kind of stories that were coming out of the disaster zone at the time. It was all about the rescue operations coming together, you know, the rituals of it all. So I think those preoccupation of the most journalists before the school scandal started to unfold itself, and then more kind of grief and scandal started to come out of the media reports. At the same time, there were also propaganda directives about positive reporting and pro-state, sort of the kind of stuff that Christian just talked about, the idea of the party being at the helm of this survival of the nation and protecting the people and so forth, that also came from the official directives as well. The kind of soft, positive coverage, like Chim Yan Bao Dao, is a very common directive. It's sort of the easier way to go around than just censoring information. So that came through as well. And then also there was public pressure actually from the bottom up, from societal actors as well. At the time, the internet was still fairly novel, but some reporters talked about this notion that they were pushed by just people online to report and to talk about, again, unity, sacrifice, and to ignore and to underplay certain sensitive issues. And some of the reporters from Southern Weekly and Cai Jing and other venues that did engage with more critical issues said they came under this pressure and were kind of labeled as sort of traitors or intruders. You know, you're coming out with this really critical message at the really wrong time. Like, this is not the time to talk about this. So they were almost like defending, nationalistically defending the state and pushing journalists to kind of respond to that and to engage in that way, which I think to me speaks to just like larger debates about nationalism as well, and the intersection between kind of bottom-up nationalism, propaganda work, and journalistic advocacy.
I was going to ask you how that kind of plays out on a local level, whose interest these things are in. I mean, there was one particular moment that I remember where I went to a village where they were doing all this construction, and it looked really beautiful. And I was, you know, I thought this is going to be a good news story. There's all this reconstruction in this village. So I got out the car, sat down to eat at the restaurant. And the first thing the restaurant owner told me was, oh, this is, they're building a new tourist village, the first Chiang village. And actually my house was not damaged in the earthquake, but they pulled it down to build a new village. And now I'm in huge debt because this is going to be a new tourist attraction. Mm-hmm. You were writing in your book about kind of Potemkin activities and face projects. How much of that was going on?
Actually, in these years when I revisited those areas, I think most of my informants already, they stopped mentioning these things, and maybe they just phased out and they already forgot about it. So what really is still continuing are those NGOs which actually actively participated after the earthquake and then keep on working in those areas. And what really made them frustrated were those projects that tried to arouse a lot of attention and catch a lot of attention at the very beginning. And many NGOs devoted their efforts and also spent resources try to continue those things. But they were frustrated that the invested resources were basically basically depleted by the local government, which seemed to have little, you know, made little significant difference to the local governors. It turned out that their efforts were just in vain. So that was, again, it's very pessimistic.
Christian, you've written about how Wenchuan was used as like a great leap forward to rebuild Sichuan, as you were talking about. I mean, how much do you think that was driven by domestic imperatives, and how much was it this idea of that the international gaze was on China?
In the three case studies in my book, I actually look at different political economic models of post-quake development. And all of them have been around for years, if not up to a decade, before the earthquake happened. So, for instance, in Dujiangyan, outside of Chengdu, they were experimenting at a slower pace with urban-rural integration. Since 2003, or even before then, but 2003 was when the campaign really kicked off. So some of the local officials in Dujiangyan that I spoke with actually said that for us the earthquake was a blessing in disguise because the houses collapsed and did the hard work of demolition for us. So in other words, now we can simply move the peasantry into these new apartment buildings and into new urban lifestyles. And so what's actually driving that is part of the broader macroeconomic shifts of, also keep in mind, 2008 with the global financial crisis. And China is wanting to readjust its macroeconomic policy away from export, from dependence on export-driven growth to domestic consumption. And so actually, lots of the internal and also public reports by the Communist Party talk about merging the post-quake reconstruction with these broader macroeconomic targets and creating new urban citizen consumers and who will buy things for their houses and their apartments. And so, you know, in the countryside is cash poor but asset rich. Right, so you move the people from the land and into the apartments, and then the expectation was, okay, now that the expectation was that they'd get jobs and then they would be integrated into the monetary economy. But for the local people who were formerly peasants now living in these apartments, most of the complaints that I heard were, we don't have a space to raise pigs. We can't pay for the electricity. Everything now depends on money, and we don't have any shuanghuo laiyuan. We don't have any source of livelihood. And part of the problem, I think, can be traced back also to the planning apparatus in that the post-earthquake, these projects look fantastic on paper, right? So you move the peasantry into the apartments, and then through this Duekojiyuan, which is the partnership program in which 18 of the affluent provinces as well as municipalities were paired with counties in the earthquake zone. And they were mandated to give at least 1% of their GDP, as well as technical assistance and all of these other things. And the idea was that, okay, we're going to also move over factories, we're going to build industrial parks, all of this money is going to flow in, which will then create jobs. So everybody in the earthquake zone will have, and every family will have at least a house or at least an apartment and one member of the family with a non-agricultural employment. So that was the plan. But as soon as pieces start falling apart, as soon as there are no jobs or all sorts of other unforeseen problems that occur through the engineering of markets, then you have basically people sitting there all day complaining, playing mahjong, and then the party is blaming them, saying, you're lazy. And they're saying there are no jobs. And no one would hire us anyway, even if they are jobs. One point I try to make in the book is that ideology doesn't just simply go away and disappear with the advent of markets. It's still about constructing specific kinds of people it's just not anymore like communist, selfless Lei Feng types. It's now, you know, complacent people consuming who are happy in their new apartments. But it's still a communist party state-led project.
And Maria, maybe you would want to talk a bit about how these kind of tensions played out in the reporting. I mean, it was very, when it comes to the reconstruction, I do remember going to visit people in their new houses and they saying you can only stay for 5 minutes because you might get caught here and we'll get in trouble. But it was actually much, much earlier that the state started clamping down on reporting in quite draconian ways, wasn't it?
Yeah, they started clamping down pretty much about a week after the school scandal started unfolding. So it was much earlier than I think for foreign media. Mm. So in terms of actually following up on all these reconstruction efforts and Potemkin kind of activities, it was almost impossible for domestic media to engage in that. There were a few reports that came out over the past essentially decades, 2009, 2010. A couple of reports did come out, some of them were collaboration with Hong Kong media, and they were quickly censored. So they basically stressed the same issues that about reconstruction, also corruption activities involved. They were questioning to what extent the money was distributed evenly. So some schools got a lot of money or some buildings and some didn't. So they asked, why is that the case? Is that fair? And then the second question they were tackling as well was to what extent the schools are actually safe? You know, are they really that well built? And if there was another disaster, would they withstand that or would they also collapse? So those were very, you know, thorny questions. So I think the report got censored, if not the day after, then a few days later it was completely gone. And nobody was really daring to push much further. So which showcases, I think, the increasing sensitivity of the political system, but also the fact that some of these responsive mechanisms of the state that we often link with like consultations and adaptations, like all those kind of positive adjectives. So it's easy to kind of say that China is adaptive, it's consulting society, and all of those very nicely done, you know, phrases. But if we think about systematic governance, it seems like the Wenchuan earthquake showcases that it's often weak, that the longer time passes, the harder it is to probe really important sensitive issues.
One of the things that I realized that we have touched upon but haven't really talked about that much is the kind of growth of the stability maintenance machine and how that was one of the outputs of the earthquake. I was in Sichuan, I think it was in 2013, where there was going to be a big protest about the Pangzhou petrochemical plant. And the authorities were so worried by this protest that they actually moved the weekend for the entire city, because the protest was meant to be at the weekend, and then they suddenly said, no, everybody has to go to school, everybody has to go to work, we're going to have the weekend on a Monday and Tuesday instead, or something like that. And then they also, at the same time, they had a kind of security exercise. So if you went to the big square, the Tianfu Square, there were police stationed every 10 meters. And it was just this extraordinary show of national strength. And I mean, you know, I wonder how much of that was based in the kind of activism that was shown immediately after the earthquake. I don't know if anybody wants to answer that, but I was going to ask all of you, is there anywhere that you can find hope?
I want to say this actually is, under the basic political structure has not been changing so much. What changes is the strategy of the Chinese state in dealing with all these things. Back then in 2008, we see a lot of flexibility and situation-based strategy to dealing with civil society and ordinary citizens, and sometimes being open, sometimes being less open, sometimes using crackdown, sometimes using encouraging and cooperative and so on and so forth. So this is why we use all kinds of terms to describe this situation, like adaptive governance or authoritarian resilience. It's actually not the resilience. It's basically what someone argued that there's a show and fun, loosening, and also it's like a strengthening or taking back this kind of alternate strategies according to situation. But now, 10 years later, we find this minimum flexibility has been disappearing. And the control over the society and the spontaneous actions and cooperation with the foundations and NGOs and even citizens are gone, or pretty much gone. So yesterday I was at a conference of a social policy, which a large part of the conference is about the poverty reduction, right? So now the Jingzhuan Fuping, the precise poverty reduction is a very funny strategy. They put labels on each household and to say who is the head of the household's name, and also the monthly income, and who is responsible for this household. So it's more like a stigmatization. And the foundations, such as the China Foundation of Poverty Alleviation's role, has been reduced into minimum, and let alone those grassroots foundations who have been working on this for many, many years. So it's much more than top-down. It's more like a total control of the situation. But this is not something new. This is just part of the authoritarian part of the governance has been strengthened in recent years. It's always there, but we tend to forget that, and we make an argument. Sometimes it could be overstated, this flexibility part of the whole issue. So it's kind of a remembering and a forgetting. Let's not forget the undercurrents or the things that are less sensational, and it's always there.
Maria, I think we've seen many examples of dominance over the media in recent months. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you take away from what happened during the Wenchuan and in the period after?
In the case of the earthquake, at the beginning, we see this kind of improvised dance and collaboration between local central officials as well as the journalists. Again, this in this theme of unity and managing the disaster, reporting certain elements, opening up more information. And then it's followed by this kind of guarded improvisation where the state ends up guarding and reigning in the space and essentially kind of combining a mixed response of a crackdown and certain kind of propagandistic view of addressing the issues. But that's completely paralleled with crackdowns. So the media is no longer allowed to investigate. It's only allowed to shape public opinion. So this investigative critical journalism gets overshadowed by the dominant function of the media in the aftermath of pretty much every disaster that we can encounter in China. And at the same time, what we see, as Bin just mentioned, that there is a certain kind of shrinkage of these spaces and a more assertive authoritarian kind of aspect of governance. So to me, disasters also often present this kind of opportunity for deeper engagement with political issues through social angles, human interest stories, and so forth, because the media and journalists are under significant pressure from their readers as well, from the public and the market, to cover those stories. They can't really avoid not covering them. Even if they cover them more carefully, they still have to engage in those crises. And the government itself, going back to this theme of transparency, is also under pressure to at least present some information to the public, because it's no longer able to completely cover up a disaster after the SARS traumatic cover-up. So in a sense, those kind of trajectories of guarded openness are still persisting, but they're again being somewhat overshadowed by increasing control, and these dynamics are going to be amplifying in the years to come.
Thank you. And finally, Christian, you titled your book Shaken Authority. I mean, what kind of lessons do you think the Communist Party took from the Wenchuan earthquake and its handling of it?
So one question that I think is useful for all of us to think about as a point of departure is, how is power actually organized in China? According to what underlying principles, how does the Communist Party think about its own power and governance and legitimacy? I'd like to borrow from a friend. Tim Cheek actually refers to Xi Jinping as China's counter-reformation. And I entirely agree with that, and I think that's a much better and apt model than a lot of what's being debated or how she is being characterized of returning to Mao or some oriental despot or etc. But actually, what I think that Xi Jinping is doing is trying to strengthen the tools of governance that he has in the political system that he is in charge of. And so what we can see through the televised confessions, what we can see things asserting, creating newer small groups at which Xi is in control of, actually all that he's doing is revitalizing the particular governance tools and strategies and discourses of the party. So I don't see the same kinds of ruptures and discontinuities. And also, I guess the last thing I want to say is the question about hope really then depends on your political standpoint. Like, hope for what? Yeah. I don't hope that China becomes a failed democracy like the US. Anyway, I don't. And what I see in China from the Wenchuan earthquake to the present is a continuation of heartbreaking betrayals of ordinary people and the working class, and I don't see that ending anytime soon.
Thank you so much to the panel. If you'd like to hear more, every member of this panel has written a book about the earthquake, and I would wholeheartedly recommend them all. Christian Sarasa's book is called Shaken Authority, China's Communist Party and the 2008 Earthquake. Xu Bin is the author of The Politics of Compassion, The Sichuan Earthquake and Civic Engagement in China. Kang Yi's book is called Disaster Management in China in a Changing Era, and Maria Repnikova's book is called Media Politics in China, Improvising Power Under Authoritarianism. So look out for those books, and thank you so much.
You've been listening to Little Red Podcast, bringing you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. Thanks to all of our guests. Find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll also find show notes on Facebook to learn more about the panel's work on the Sichuan earthquake. This episode was recorded at the annual meeting of the Association for Asian Study. Our theme music is by Susie Wilkins, and our cartoons and GIFs are courtesy of Zeb Danton.